appearance heralded the return. Glorify, he spoke coldly. Orchid turned to the sky with restless anguish. There are two now. Yes, he said, going nearer to her. He pointed at the second star. Yes, it appeared late in the afternoon. It's faint, but it will get brighter. You must know I consult minds other than yours. These wise minds tell me another and another and another rocket will come, until they are all here. Watch. Look. He held his hand before her eyes, extending each finger rigidly in sequence. Five. All together. But, she began. You are a translator, he said. A scribe. Before your accident, when your visions were accurate, you'd earned your place with me. I trusted you, when we used to look at auguries of the future to discover how I died. If I would die. Do you remember? This girl is no visionary. I've asked her to predict my death many times. She makes up answers. They are wrong. Only fantasies. But they charm me. She's charming. But you, wife, what do you do for me now? Find fault with what we've written? Tell me that I am not the best person to interpret my own visions. You hear how stupid you sound, don't you? His eyes flickering in the green torch were blank. We will perform the star sapphire ritual with Aurora, just as I've planned. First thing tomorrow, you will attend. Happily. No. Orchid clenched her jaw. Never. Put down your dress. You are indecent. Though they spoke almost inaudibly, the girl wondered if anyone on the shore could hear their argument. Orchid's hand hadn't moved, her fist a tight rose against her thigh, with fabric bulging from the crevices between her fingers. The girl noticed with alarm that hand was creeping slowly toward the grip of the knife. Orchid's voice was throttled with jealousy. David, my love, say she is your wife if you have to, but say we will sacrifice her to the great work. Let me sacrifice her. I know what to do. I always know what to do. In Orchid's eyes, an inchoate rage began to boil, and the girl sensed she would strike out with the knife at any moment. The girl began to creep toward the side of the barge. She would jump into the black water if Orchid reached for the blade. Mr. Capellatio, an executioner after all, must have felt the swelling tension, or else he knew his wife's nature well enough to predict what she would do. In a single moment that passed almost too quickly to see, Mr. Capellatio darted at Orchid and pulled the knife straight out of her boot. He sliced her skin in the process. She howled a high and vivid scream, but still managed to lunge after the knife with her fingertips. It slipped past. Mr. Capellatio had already swung it behind her, and in the same motion, he grabbed her by the hair and turned her almost entirely around, until she was bent backward over his knee, where he held her, where at any moment he could break her back or slit her throat or stab her in the heart. Then slowly, he pulled her long, pale hair off the hair form and around his arm, and she was staring up at him with wide, hate-filled eyes. The three of them on the raft were at once alone in a world of their own making, roiling and rolling together like bubbles in a fountain. Mr. Capellatio raised the knife to Orchid's neck. The girl watched, her breath trapped. Orchid closed her eyes, a look of hunger on her face, and strange courage. Hovering motionless on the edge of the raft, the girl became aware of a new emotion roaring in her heart like a beast. She wanted to protect her husband. She thought of him that way now. Her body tensed like a single muscle. Orchid's eyes remained closed in anticipation. But when the blow came, it was not to her neck, but to her hair. Mr. Capellatio sliced her hair off in four sawing thrusts, tossed it by handfuls over the side of the barge. He was smiling now, a genuine smile, his head-cutting smile. But he was angry, too. She could see it. He pushed Orchid upright, steadied her, and then threw her knife into the sea as well with an angry grunt. It disappeared beneath the inky water. How is that for a sacrifice? His voice frightened the girl. A smear of blood stained the lower half of Orchid's dress. Her hair now floated in a jagged cloud about her ears, released of its former weight. Calm closed in on them like a cotton veil. Some spell he had done in the cutting must have momentarily subdued her. The girl wondered, was it really magic? That knife was from the launch sites, Orchid whispered. Where will I get another one? It sounded as if she were trying to make a joke, because of course she cared nothing for the knife, nothing for anything else she'd lost except her power. Mr. Capellatio pulled the girl back into the center of the raft and wrapped his arms around her, tucking her in close. He laughed angrily. Oh, but you won't need a knife in the cages, woman, which is where you're going right after this. She made no expression. Who will do the Star Sapphire ritual with you if I'm in the cages? I had assumed such an honor would be my fate. Her words were bitter. You will do what I tell you to do. I think that's what annoys me so much about you these days. He wiped his bloody hand on the sleeve of the girl's dress. Orchid closed and opened her eyes, the way a person does when they are trying to wake up. The crowd had turned silent. He pushed on her shoulder now, almost playfully. The girl could tell he was enraged. His chest was hot through his clothes. Say your lines. He paused. Loudly, please. From some pocket in her dress, she produced a folded square of paper, and after the girl and Mr. Capellatio had taken their positions facing each other, and after the crowd had clapped for what felt like an age, Orchid began to read the words, haltingly at first, and then with less apprehension, until she sounded not just normal, but entirely convicted, and the magical words moved between the girl and Mr. Capellatio and snaked past them, out into the waiting host of people, each one of them a believer, each one filled with the wonder of ritual. After a moment, Orchid took from between her small breasts a vial of blood and continued, "This is the daughter of fortitude, the fawn of the battlefield," she called. "Behold, she is understanding, and science dwells within her, and the heavens covet her. She is ringed by the circle of stars, and covered with the morning clouds. She is ravished every hour by glory. She is deflowered, yet a virgin. She sanctifies, but has yet to be sanctified herself. Happy is he who embraces her, for in the days she is sweet, and in the nights full of pleasure. Her company forms a harmony of many symbols, so purge your streets, sons of men, and wash your lands clean with blood for this eon. Make yourselves holy and put on righteousness. She will in time bring forth children, and these will be the sons of comfort in the coming age. The age of the true king, the age of times. Glorify." And it went on this way. A chant for many minutes, until at last Orchid opened the vial of blood and poured it over their joined hands and kissed them both on the cheek, her mouth drawn closed over her teeth, and the girl felt the cool blood go over their skin. Whose blood was it? But it was Orchid's, of course, she knew without asking. Then Mr. Capellatio kissed her for a very long time and pressed his body against her. Startled, she felt his hardness and was confused. She had thought he was angry. She let herself be led wordlessly onto the sand again. In the flickering light, her hand looked black with drying blood. Orchid marched ahead of them on the beach and stood in front of everyone for a moment, appearing dizzy, like she had just awoken from a nap. Then she whirled around and knelt in the sand before Mr. Capellatio. He looked at her, unmoved. Her body in her blue dress as she spread out on the ground was beautiful, even to the girl. She chastised herself for her own jealousy. Orchid thrust her face up. I have misread the scriptures in relation to this wedding. When he returned with the lucky sigil, I admit my heart complained. I could not see his larger plan for our great work. I did not interpret the scriptures correctly. Our master has reprimanded me. We made our peace at once. He shows us daily what perfect love is. And witness, I am still his wife. Wife of his first heart. I am his first wife. He has not cast me out. But this was no apology. Even the girl recognized Orchid was trying to force his hand. Mr. Capellatio watched with a placid expression. He bent next to Orchid and spoke a few words in her ear. Then he straightened and smiled brilliantly at his people. They stood all around, stunned. There would be no undoing this fiasco. Faces pressing inward upon them. He brushed sand from his knees. He offered a hand to Orchid, who did not take it. Someone escort my radiance to the cages. Not my tent. This is my wedding night. He was still smiling. And she has nearly ruined it. Do it now, he repeated, as two men picked up Orchid and pulled her bodily to her feet. Though she rose calmly, there was something racked and demeaned about the way she tensed her shoulders, with multiplicities of anger squeezing her like a vice, making her smaller and harder yet, her solid small arms and their muscles clenching and unclenching like breaths. Mr. Capellatio turned his back on her. He called out for everyone to hear. Now we dance, and drink, and prepare. Come and greet your queen, the third queen of Cape Canaveral. She is the true queen for the age of times. Look to the sky, at the returning shuttles, and rejoice! From this day we enter a new age. Everyone gazed at the shooting stars in the sky, now numbering two. There were definitely two, even if the second was faint. But the girl watched the two men pull Orchid away through the crowd. She watched the way the crowd closed up behind her like soft tissue after a puncture wound. The crowd swelled into the processional aisle, and there was suddenly music again, and someone knocked over a torch, and a man caught his cloak on fire and ran laughing and screaming into the sea. Chapter 13 Tell Lochvovin. After his humiliating audience with Allison, John Sousa, chief orbital doctor, took Tygo back to Urania at a gallop, so Marvel Parsons would not have time to intervene. John had a set of gigantic stone spheres among his predictive devices that could be moments away from achieving their purpose, and he wished to see them with new eyes. The spheres were made of limestone rich in fossilized shells and were numbered 5, just like the shuttles. They'd been constructed for him over the course of 20 years, and they were, as far as he could measure, perfectly round. The magicians who made them claimed to have employed a potion that softened stone until it was workable as clay. John didn't doubt this, but he had never seen it. The spheres, when they were finally finished, were immensely heavy and had been moved out to Urania one by one by a team of 17 horses, and each sphere was placed exactly on an astronomical alignment that should, according to every calculation John had ever made during the 20 years it took the magicians to prepare the stones, match perfectly with the position of the shuttles upon their return. He ran like an excited child into his observation yard, his circumferenter in hand, and lifted high so he might begin to measure the horizontal angles before he even came to a complete stop. The two comets blazed now, one brighter than the other in the night sky. In the distance, he could see the outlaw carnival's bright green glow. He had never known a carnival to use green torches. What could it mean? But after a few moments, he'd dropped his arms. He did not even need to use the circumferenter. His angles were plainly off. There was no alignment whatsoever between his spheres and these new objects, whatever they were. There was surely the chance that John's calculations were merely wrong, that he'd been wrong enough in his life, and it was his own vanity that clung to these erroneous positions. But no, in the end, the spheres seemed to signify nothing. He stood there, bereft of all direction, with Tygo at his side. Tygo, who knew nothing of the spheres or any of the other perfectly aligned water tables and dials and disks that John had used so inertly throughout his tenure as chief astronomer. Then, without knowing exactly why, a terrible anger overtook him. Not at Tygo, but at the idea of Tygo. At his luck. His faith in himself. The entire situation was preposterous. By no means could it be true that the angels had told Tygo about the return. There were no angels. There could not be. He would not believe it. And yet, what could this be other than the return? John felt black with fury as Tygo was strolling around the courtyard, with his hands still shackled, looking with passive interest at the circular metal domes, hiding what was not in use. The torches along the front wall of the house had been lit, and in the shadows, Tygo's ear holes looked like pits. Here and there he touched the domes with his shackled hands, which sent John into a private agony, until he felt like tossing up his hands in defeat. At last, Tygo turned his eyes to John. He waved across the courtyard. John waved back. He gloomily called out, "Why don't you call down your angels now, since my own attempts have always come to nothing? I'd like to see you try, actually." Light from one of the torches bounced off Tygo's manacles. "That would be a very good idea. Clarification, assurance, but..." He shook the shackles and smiled hopefully. "I'm sure you'll manage," replied John. "You do know I've only ever spoken with the angels that one single time, using my own personal shaving mirror. Surely the angels wouldn't mind you using a less humble mirror," John replied acidly. "They are angels, after all. But I have many such mirrors. In fact, I possess a beautiful mirror, a black granite chip of the sky mirror itself."
"Sky mirror?
The monument here at the Cape? Built by the ancients for all the known martyrs who gave their lives in spaceflight? That also lists the names of the noble families for posterity?" Tygo's expression didn't change. "Surely the angels would prefer that mirror to a shaving mirror," John pressed. Tygo seemed confused for a split second. A shadow darted across his eyes, but he covered it quickly.
"Why didn't you tell me you had a mirror?"
John smirked. "Such objects are strictly for priests and magicians of the highest order. Did you not say you hated magic?" Tygo nodded. "But I thought I made it clear that my conversation with the angels was an accident. I never called them. I wouldn't know how to begin scrying or whatever you call it. I abhor the utensils of your profession. I told you." John continued to smirk. "All the same, you are now in my employ, and it seems prudent to get to the bottom of this matter as quickly as possible. We did tell Allison that we would report to her tomorrow with additional knowledge, did we not? Are you not looking forward to that?" He shrugged. "It doesn't matter to me if we see her or not. She was the one who requested the meeting. But I guess we have to tell her something. Maybe I'll see something." He paused. "Stranger things have happened to me. Since I've arrived here, I've done so many things I never thought I would do. What's one more?"
It was a curious thing to say. What had he done that he never thought he would do? But John let it go and led the other man to his office, where he peevishly lit a whole host of candles that spat their trembling shadows onto the walls. John kept his chip of the sky mirror on an intricate holder he'd commissioned some years back. Draped over it, however, was a plain cloth, a dust rag, really, old and stained from handling. He withdrew the cloth and presented the palm-sized mirror as though showing off a finely crafted art object. He couldn't help himself. He had gone to such lengths to steal it and hide it all these years. Tygo snickered, but quickly tightened his mouth over his lips in an effort not to offend. John was offended. He used the underside of the cloth to briefly shine the black granite. Tygo came up to the mirror and hunched over it, peering over its flat surface and blinking. He glanced at John, scrutinizing his face for instruction. John frowned meanly. He had no intention of helping. At last, Tygo placed his fingers on the rock's shining surface, and John audibly laughed.
"That's not how it's done, man."
Tygo tipped his chin.
"Well, you were probably doing it wrong. That's why you never saw anything."
"How do you know I never saw anything?"
"If you had, you wouldn't be so desperate for me to look."
He paused.
"What are we looking for again?"
John roughly pushed him away from the chip.
"My God, man! We're looking for confirmation!"
"From the angels?"
He tossed up his hands.
"Look, in my career, I've written an entire reinterpretation of our cosmology. I've scoured records from 1,000 years ago. I've spent 20 years and more at this task. I'm in midlife now, and only just realizing that everything I've believed was likely based on faulty math and my own hubris and some gross condition of the world, which has convinced me until now that magic... that it mattered. Bah!"
He shook his head.
"We're looking for the sublime. What did you think we were looking for? Why do you think you've kept your head this long? You said you could see things. So see them!"
Tygo nodded and rolled his sleeves up.
"Right. I'm sorry. I'll scribe for you."
He hesitated still, then placed a palm on John's shoulder.
"I did have a vision. I promise you. I know your work may have been misguided, but it hasn't been in vain."
"Bah!" John said again. "Did you see the shuttles returning in your vision? Did the angels tell you they were returning?"
"What I saw can't be communicated in words."
John rolled his eyes.
"How convenient. You know, I regret listening to you at all."
"Don't say that."
"No, I believe I've been taken in by some scheme. I'm sure I'll be punished soon enough for it. And when that happens, I won't forget you. You will pay for tricking me."
Tygo shook his head.
"You have it all wrong. I'm not tricking you. I need you. You specifically. To help me understand my vision. I've told you I'm not skilled in astronomics. I have no idea what anything I saw might mean."
He spoke more softly.
"What I'm trying to tell you is that this may be the return. It may really be."
"Why, then, did you advise Allison that it definitely was?"
Tygo spread his hands.
"I only said it may be."
"I don't think that's what she heard." "It's not what I heard. You have confessed to me you are a liar."
"I'm not lying, Lord Astronomer."
John folded his arms calmly over his chest.
"Then prove it. Scry for me."
Tygo nodded again.
"Well, that was part of the bargain, after all."
"It was the whole part of the bargain," John snapped.
Tygo gathered his wits and took his place again at the mirror, and taking a bit of his own sleeve, wiped the rock absently a few times.
"Can you cut off my shackles?"
"Not even on my mind, my man. It hasn't crossed my mind."
Then John waited. Nothing happened. Finally, Tygo said,
"You may as well take a seat. I can't promise you'll see anything yourself. It was just me at the mirror that first time, and I think I mentioned that when it occurred, I'd been somewhat at the drink."
John raised his eyebrows.
"It was a habit I'd gotten into. Regrettable, but when it happened before, I'd had, oh, several or three glasses of wine. Do you have any?"
John stormed through the manor house, into the kitchens, and removed a bottle of citrus liqueur from the storeroom, used for flavoring, he assumed, and without checking the glasses for dust, he poured 2 hasty cupfuls of the stuff and brought it all back, balanced upon one of Mizar's many inlaid trays. The bottle, too. He thrust the assortment at Tygo, who lifted the bottle and inspected it, wrinkling his nose. But he said nothing, raised his glass, and took the entire drink in a single draught, and waited until John had done the same, although John had to take two swallows, as he was unaccustomed to swilling strong liquids. After that first gulp, his chest and gut seemed to catch like a fire. He teetered on his feet. Tygo held up his glass as if for more, and John supplied it, and then he too took another cupful, and then he felt like sitting down, which he did on the chaise lounge at the other end of the room. Tygo closed his eyes like a child concentrating, and then went back to the mirror, cracked his knuckles, gazed at his own reflection in the black opalescent stone, and steadied himself as though for a duel. Then John waited. They both waited, for what seemed like an age, in their respective positions, John on the sofa, and Tygo across the room, standing unmoving over the mirror. John eventually slid into a slumber, for when he lurched awake, the candles were much lower and Tygo was still standing, stock still at the mirror, his black pigtail hanging lank on his skull. John realized he was damp and chilled, and saw the fireplace empty. A bubble of irritation burst within him, and he creaked to his feet, intending to fetch Mizar and reprimand him for not making the fire. One evening duty. Was it so much to ask? The bottle of yellow liqueur winked merrily at him from the side table, and John discovered himself pouring another drink before he managed to leave the room. He sipped it this time instead of gulping. He somewhat enjoyed the warm feeling of the fluid sliding down his innards. Tygo had yet to move, but his cup was empty. John went to refill it, but when he approached the other man, he saw Tygo was not asleep, not awake, but open-eyed and vacant, with his mouth half agape, the pupils of the eyes hugely dilated. John tripped backward in the startle, dropping the liqueur glasses. They smashed on the granite floor. Like some blind bird, Tygo turned slowly to John, his face dead-looking, mercury gray. Around them, the air pulsed with motion, as though spinning through fan blades. A pleasant breeze. But John noted in a slight panic that the window was not open. Even if it had been, it was November, and the wind could not possibly be so warm. He gripped Tygo's shoulder and shook him. Tygo continued to face him with that horrible expression. John grew more and more alarmed. He lifted his hand and actually slapped Tygo across the face. No response. He yanked back his hand, shocked at himself. It was as though he had been driven to do it. He had not even known what he was doing. Tygo loomed above the mirror, the black surface reflecting back nothingness. Where had his reflection gone? John choked. The small star tattoos on Tygo's temples stood out, almost raised, like the hair of a hissing cat. Suddenly, Tygo began to speak in a bizarre language, words John had never heard and could not understand. Each word seemed to be longer than the last. Quite a few had escaped the other man's lips before John had the wherewithal to leap to his desk and pull out a pad and begin transcribing. They were strange to the ear, and ungainly to write. He could not tell when one word ended and the next began. Frantic, he scribbled, setting down sound after sound, writing as phonetically as he could manage. And this continued for some amount of time. John was not sure how long. Enraptured and terrified as he was, to be receiving anything that even resembled a miracle. It occurred to him momentarily that Tygo was playing him for the worst kind of fool, but he let the suspicion out of his mind as one might let a hound into the garden, knowing full well it may dig up the flowers, this relinquishment oddly satisfying. Sometime later, minutes or hours, John had no idea, Tygo's words ran dry, and he was himself again, alight with excitement and confusion. He still stood at the mirror, drenched now in sweat. The first thing he did was wipe his brow with his sleeve. Then he sank to the floor and began, improbably, to laugh. John thrust his papers up to the candlelight and poked at them. "What is this?" Tygo continued to laugh.
Angel language. I don't know. You tell me. But what did you see? You looked ghastly, like a corpse someone dug up. You must tell me. I've never seen anything like that. Were you putting me on? How did you do it?
Tygo sighed happily and put his hands to his face.
I don't know. It just happened. Like before. For a long time, nothing happened. I was just standing there feeling stupid. Then I was seeing these strange grids, one atop the other, with small portions of the grids laid out backwards. But after a while, the squares on the grids flipped over, and then I was seeing a whole idea, a whole world, and I could exist in angelic time. Inside an event, maybe.
He trailed off. Seeing John's expression, he shook his head.
See, I told you before. It's like explaining a dream.
No, explain. You have to explain, John said, brandishing the paper maniacally. I wrote down everything you said. I copied out the sounds of the language. We can figure it out. If you can recall any of the physical visions, perhaps we can match them to the words. I've spent my life studying arcane nonsense.
He laughed bitterly.
Did you? Is this the return?
They peered at the papers together. The pages were awash with impenetrable symbols, each more inexplicable than the last. Stunned by the sheer unreadableness, they sat side by side in silence for some moments. Beyond them, shards of glass sparkled in the weak light. The broken cups. At last, John remarked in a mild voice,
You can't know how it feels to watch a person truly experience the sublime. I've waited all my life to see a miracle.
Tygo nodded.
If you are a con man, I damn you, and you should be hung off the walls of the palace as a bounty for the seagulls.
But if you are a visionary, he exhaled, I have never witnessed anything like that.
Tygo nodded.
Is this the return?
He asked again. Tygo pinched his temples with his fingers.
I don't know.
What did you see?
I think we'll need to do a very thorough study of these angelic words and how they correspond to the data you've collected so far. That will take weeks. What did you see?
Tygo met John's eyes.
I saw what I saw before.
He took the papers and held them once more to the light, pointing to a scribble near the end of the transcription.
That word there. You haven't written it right, but you got the general idea.
I remember that word.
I saw it in the first vision, too. That word is important. Tell Lokvovin.
What does it mean?
Tygo shrugged.
That's what you're supposed to figure out.
He hesitated.
I do know what it means, technically, but not what it means cosmically, if that makes sense.
John frowned at him.
Tell Lokvovin.
The other man frowned back.
It means falling death.
Thereafter, elated but also peculiarly overcome, they each drank more of the citrus liqueur. They took turns at the bottle, enough to stuff their heads with pleasantness and wonder at what had just transpired, and it was altogether confusing but mostly agreeable, until Mizar inserted himself into the room and began fretfully to sweep up the glass, reminding John of how he never took drink, and shouldn't he think of his health? John was then seized by an unreasonable aggravation and spent minutes lecturing the poor man on his negligence in regard to the matter of the unlit fire until Mizar hung his head, which was as much of an apology as Mizar ever issued. By then, John felt depressed by his own tantrum and unsteady on his feet. Tygo had passed out on the chaise lounge. It was with a heavy heart that John allowed Mizar to lug him off to his chamber and place him in bed. Beside him on the night table, Mizar filled a blue crystal glass with water and instructed John to drink all of it before he slept. But John drank none. Chapter 14 The Unicursal Hexagram. On her wedding night, she thought of her brothers. Argento, of course. There was always Argento. But also she wondered about her other brother, William, who had been driven from her mother's settlement for thievery before she was born. Her mother said William had run off to be a con man, a swindler who posed as a walking doctor. Could he have been in that crowd of onlookers? Was one of those faces his? If so, she wouldn't have known him. She thought of them both as she walked hand in hand with her new husband back to the tent. Now she had a husband. He would protect her from men like them, men who could hurt her. Mr. Capellatio had said, "The difference is, I'll only hurt you on the inside." She remembered Argento's broken body before Mr. Capellatio cut off his head. Argento had kept his courage in the end. The girl's hate for him had transformed, and her pity as well, and now she wondered how she had ever been afraid of him. He seemed so far away, he could not touch her. When the wedding dance ended and they came back to the tent, Mr. Capellatio sat across from her on the carpets. There had been laughing and singing and dancing, and then cups had appeared and folk had begun a raucous revel. Mr. Capellatio had stolen her away, back here to the soft, pillowed ground. The quiet. Then, slowly, as her head cleared, she found herself trying to transform her husband's face into her brother's. There were no wrinkles on Mr. Capellatio's forehead, but she remembered Argento's thick and somewhat scarred skin so fully in that instant that she couldn't believe he wasn't here, that she wasn't there, back in his musty tent beneath mildewed blankets. If she tried, she could see in Mr. Capellatio some likeness of Argento, if she looked hard enough. Their eyes, for instance, were nearly the same color, and their hair was not that different. Maybe they looked like brothers. Suddenly she couldn't tell. She wondered if she had drunk too much. She searched for something on his face that didn't remind her of her brother, and it was a long while before she realized that they hardly looked similar at all. They looked nothing alike. Her brother had been tall, very tall. She remembered that well, but Mr. Capellatio was of an average height. Was she disappointed by that? How shallow. She wondered if she was also of an average height. Orchid was a woman, and taller than the girl, and there was no one else to compare herself to. She felt her eyes closing, but he still wanted to sit there in silence. What was he doing? Now she felt sad that there had been no one she knew to witness her marriage and tell her if she'd looked happy. There had been no one to tell the girl if she looked beautiful. Had she looked beautiful? Had she been happy? She couldn't tell. She thought she should feel different, now that they were married, but she didn't know if she did. And in that instant, the dam of emptiness burst within her. She did miss Argento. He had burned the unicursal hexagram into her thigh and dragged her through blood-spattered fields on her knees and never spoken to her with any kindness at all. But she missed him. He was her brother, the only one she had ever known. She wanted to hold Cosmas, the head he'd made her, Cosmas the Uncrusher, but Mr. Capellatio had hidden it high up in one of his boxes. She began to sob. Mr. Capellatio studied her as though this were no great thing. They continued to sit across from one another while she cried, him with his legs crossed beneath him, and she with her knees drawn up to her chest. At first she sobbed loudly, with heaving breaths. But finally they slowed, and Mr. Capellatio extended a hand to her and caressed the bulb of her knee. His fingers were gentle. He pulled her forward by her leg and kissed her forehead. He whispered, "Did you not like the wedding?" He kissed her again. "I think other people liked it. I'm sorry about Orchid. She acted very badly." He shrugged. "But the wedding was still nice." She said nothing. "Do you know what today is?" She shook her head. "It's November 14th, your wedding day. We've been together now for 7 months." She began to cry again. She couldn't help it. All the moments of the life she'd lived with her oldest brother rushed back to her at once. It was a torture she could not will from her mind. She remembered the horse Argento had let her ride, a broken-down palomino that he cursed and said was no good for pulling their wagon anymore. Where was that horse now? Surely dead, like everyone else. And also the way at night Argento had crept into her tent with his bottle of foul-smelling drink clutched like a baby to his breast, and how he would take long, voracious gulps while barely sitting up. And sometimes he would choke, and she was forced to slap him on the back to clear the fluid from his windpipe, and how he stared at her with watery eyes and smiled, something he never did when he wasn't drinking, and how he looked when he slept, so compressed and uncomfortable on his bedroll, how she had, at times, recovered his feet when she thought he was cold. But when he woke up, all those moments were forgotten, and his cruelty returned. Mr. Capellatio hugged her and whispered, "It's all right, Aurora." She was happier now. She was sure of it. Mr. Capellatio smiled all the time. He slept with his cheek pressed to the pillow so handsomely, his breath easy in and out, and inviting. She liked lying close beside him and had become accustomed to sidling up next to him, pressing into the curve of his body. She felt that they were two caterpillars, knitted together into a cocoon. Mr. Capellatio watched her tenderly. "You really don't have to cry." But she could not stop, so he took her by the shoulders and held her face up to his own like a mirror. "Today is also the day I became the true king. Aren't you happy for me? For us? Aren't you excited that the shuttles are returning?"
"I was thinking of my brother."
He nodded grimly. "Yes, I've been thinking of him, too." He extricated her from his arms. He grabbed her by the leg and thrust her dress up past her hips. She gasped, surprised. Had he gotten the idea from Orchid's display at the wedding? His hands were prodding the burn mark Argento had given her 2 years before, when her mother abandoned her to his carnival. "This," said Mr. Capellatio. His fingers mushed at the skin, puckering it and smoothing it out again, the lines inward falling, boundless symmetry. As above, so below. "This is not fit for my wife. This is another denomination sigil, the mark of a foreign cosmology, and the personal brand of an indigent rapist. Highly, highly unfavorable for our magic. Very disturbing. I've been very kind. I overlooked it this long because I hate to cause you pain. But now is a time of change for us all. That idiot cannot ride with us into the Cape when we take the palace. Not him. Not his brand." She covered the mark with her hand. "I'm a kind man. I was just born with mercy. I can't help it. I've let you keep that marking longer than I should. But I'm sure you understand that no one can ever see it. So we will be removing it tonight. Right now." He said it like a taunt. He pulled a short knife from his waistband of his pants. She backed away from him like a crab, terrified, until her shoulder hit a low-hanging lantern and sent a carousel of red and black shadows around the tent. She yanked the wedding dress down over her thigh.
"No!
We have no choice." She stumbled to her feet and dashed to the far side of the tent, where she hid behind her cage.
"You promised you would never hurt me."
"It won't hurt. Not much, anyway. Don't be a coward." In the months since Mr. Capellatio had taken her, she'd become less and less accustomed to the awfulness that before had regularly consumed her life. She was rarely cold now, and never hungry, and when they collided together at night in the bed, it had felt like lovemaking, and never like whatever she'd had before, the pain of which she could stand, but which slowly had chipped away at something inside her, leaving a formless emotion that she could not name. Her skin was softer now, her body was healthier, and her breasts had become larger. She realized she'd thought she was almost safe. "Orchid was right, Queenie. We should make sacrifices for the great work. She should. You should. I should."
What is the great work? She shrieked. Please tell me.
He tossed his dark hair. I'm not that easily distracted. Little manipulator, you're already learning from her, I see. But it will be a long time before you're smarter than me. He considered. Longer still before you're smarter than her. What a fine place she made out there on the beach. The affront burns me up. But by heaven, she's a woman of many intriguing talents. I don't think anyone could criticize my choice of brides. First or second. He paused. Tell me, did you think our wedding was enough? Be honest, I think I heard people complaining of the food. She blinked in bewilderment. He flashed one hand at her dismissively. Oh, what do you know? You're just a child. He turned the little knife over and around in his hands. She wasn't sure where he was headed. He would never be so cold that he could cut out her brand while she thrashed and screamed beneath him. But she had seen him behead her own brother. Had Argento deserved it? She didn't know. All the things she didn't know. Perhaps Mr. Capellatio really did know better than her. Slowly she peeked out from behind the cage. He was still talking. Often he talked to himself in the same voice he used when he was talking to her. People are so ungrateful, he was muttering. I try to overlook it. I'm trying to overlook your ungratefulness right this second. What are you doing hiding from me? I'm your husband. I queened you. You are the most important thing in all the land, maybe even more important than me. And you're hiding. Unbelievable. We came to the Cape to save people, Aurora. How can you save people if you're afraid to do this small thing? What if they see that brand and think you're a blasphemer? Your brother's carnival had an archaic view of the return. Have you not read any of the books I gave you? He demanded. Of course you haven't. He smiled meanly. I was reading. I am reading. I haven't had any time. He laughed at that, a deep whirling laugh. You do what I tell you to do. I told you to read the books.
I will. I'll read them.
He smiled. That's the first time you admitted you can read.
Well, I can.
He scooted on his hands and knees around the cage until he was sitting close to her again. She could smell a tinge of the spicy sweet scent he'd worn for the wedding. This near, even with him holding the knife, she did not feel entirely afraid of him, and she didn't know why.
You said I was important, she whispered. You told everyone I was.
He took her by the shoulders. You are. Very.
Then you should ask me what I want.
All right. What do you want?
I want to know what everything means,
he scowled. How should I know?
Because you're the king.
If I knew what everything meant, I wouldn't be in this drafty tent, getting ready to cut a brand off a little girl, would I? He snapped.
What's the great work? Orchid told me about it. What is the Star Sapphire ritual?
She kept her eyes on one of the hanging mobiles of glass and chalk he'd hung from the eaves of his wagon. It did not turn. There was no wind inside the tent. Mr. Capellatio lost his frown. A good question. You're bright. So bright. A sigil of knowledge. I'm still so happy I took you away from that idiot carnival full of raving idiots. Did you know I grew up in a place like that? A carnival just like your brother's, with those backwards convoluted rites that went on for 2 weeks straight. And all of it was just sex magic. You know that? And it was lurid. It was repugnant. I left. That's all you need to know. When I was 15, I came to the Prophetess Lois, and I met Orchid. And that is a story for another time.
I wish you would tell me now.
The great work is the work we've done since Lois became the Prophetess. To reform the texts, the cosmology, everything. I've spent my life at this work. Lois designed the Star Sapphire ritual. She was my spiritual mother, the first one who divined that I was the true king. It's a ceremony of power, where a woman may become one with heaven.
And only by performing this rite will you be truly fit to be the queen of Cape Canaveral.
What do I have to do?
The prophetess passed from this earth 11 years ago. She named me as her successor over her own natural-born son. She was an aged woman of 79 when she died. She took me in when no one would. I was raised by degenerates in circumstances not unlike your own. But, he said, the ritual is beautiful. Violently beautiful. Her ritual. She gave it to us because she knew I was the true king. His eyes were far away, the clear brown of that first inch of seawater. You know, I didn't want to be the king at first. Then he shrugged. We all must make sacrifices. He moved toward her with the knife, and his voice was sad. Queenie, give me your leg. I must do it. He paused. You know I don't want to. She cried. I can do it myself. Her head now felt strangely hot and cold, a flush of fear rising through up the web of her veins and pulsing into her cheeks. A thought intruded. This is the world. This is the world. She took his wrist in her own hand with such strength it surprised even her.
I will burn it off. It was burned on. We'll burn it off.
Mr. Capellatio eyed her intently. Burn it? I suppose we could burn it. Blood is better, though. It is only by our collective blood rinse that the world will renew itself. That is wonder blood. You know it well. But possessed by an inner vision, as if by dictating the terms of her pain she could control it, the girl recalled when her brother Argento had burned the hexagram onto her thigh. How on her first day in his camp, she was weeping angrily at Gimbal, her mother, having tears of pure, polished anger. Even after walking with her mother so many weeks over land through the wilderness of the country, the rolling world a joyful, sensual experience, despite every ancient calamity that had befallen it, and even though her mother cursed it and called it contagious, even after anticipating her abandonment for the entirety of the journey, the girl had still failed to comprehend the scale of the betrayal. Only when she at last sat alone with her brother in his tent did she understand how alone she really was. Argento towered over her, this man she did not remember. Her anguish had been enough to drown out even the sizzling of the hot iron on skin.
But it's the return, she said. The shuttles are back. The eon of pain is over. I thought there should be no more blood spilled if the shuttles are back.
He set down the knife, wiped his hand on the ends of his shirt. It could be. I hadn't thought of that. And he looked at her with new respect. You are a thinker. I'll have to check the texts, but you may be right. In the end, they agreed to the burning. The brand would be obscured by a hot welt that would over time become a pulpy scar that would over time become a skin-colored raisin. A blemish. A nothing. By then, she felt unafraid. She felt full of magic. When he cut off her wedding dress and she held the heated iron, this iron was her husband's own sigil, a rocket ship. The brand that marked the bodies of his horses and goats, that was carved into the wagons and painted on all his canvas tents. He looked at her so lovingly, her pale, naked body that was still not quite a woman's body. When she held the iron above her skin for a long moment, he was quick to show her a place on his body she had not seen before. On the back of his left thigh, under a whirl of dark hair, he bore the same mark. When she did it, she imagined Cosmas the Uncrusher, with his diamond-studded face, her protector. She imagined he was undoing her pain. It must have worked, because she was able to hold the brand steady. The heated iron on her thigh felt ice cold. Afterward, he splashed water on her face and made a poultice, bound the leg in a bandage. He kissed her. It was more than Argento had done.
Chapter 15 Friendship. Marvel Parsons spoke to King Michael late that night. He continued to have difficulty devising a believable reason for sending a convict surgeon to attend the royal pardoness, so he decided not to mention it. Who else would tell Michael anything about the earless man besides John Sousa, who was, as always, preoccupied to a fault with his divinations? The comets, whatever they were, had granted Marvel a fine enough distraction. Yet he still keenly felt his duty to the king. Though he tried his best to ignore it, he could not help thinking of their friendship. Michael had been good to Marvel. Perhaps this would be the last time they would meet. Marvel had mixed his poisons and made his bag ready. He could never have explained to Michael his decision to leave without notice, to disappear, to give up all agency, all responsibility. He probably could not have explained it to anyone. The king lived in a simple three-room house, far below the sweeping vistas and dizzying heights of his six beautiful spires. He had been eating a late dinner at his plain wooden table when Marvel arrived.
"We have had an exciting day, haven't we?"
Michael spooned soup into his mouth, his blonde beard glistening.
"The comets! An outlaw carnival!"
"Very strange indeed.
I think surely these comets must signal the return."
Michael laid his spoon on the rough wood and wiped his lips.
"Sousa must draw up a horoscope. I wonder what planet is ascendant, if this is a favorable day."
He took a drink. His cup was wood. Inside it only water. Ever.
"What a time to be alive, eh? You must admit it's exciting."
"Surely the Outlaw Carnival is more concerning," he sighed.
"You know, I think one of my new guards may be a spy." He spoke offhandedly, but he'd already decided Juniper would go with him when he fled the Cape. The only way to ensure his loyalty was to remain friendly with him, to pay him as he'd promised, and to convince him, through the subtle art of manipulation, that it was Juniper's own idea to bring Marvel back to Kansas with him. Marvel didn't think it would be difficult. Juniper was an attractive man, and Marvel liked him for more than his knowledge of the deathscapes. Trust would happen, if he gave it time. There was no need to torture him. Michael waved a hand and spoke aloud what Marvel had already known he would say.
"We have spies all the time. Have them executed if you think so. I don't like to hear of it. Take some soup, priest."
So Marvel sat.
"Michael, we are friends."
"Of course so.
I have always thought you a fine king. Better than your father."
Michael nodded.
"I've tried."
It was true that Michael was the best king the Cape had seen in generations. He was slow to judgment, kindly indifferent to women. He deeply trusted men more knowledgeable than himself, yet was not blind to poor character. He had executed many a false courtier upon the great execution stage, and ordered Marvel to take care of others more discreetly. Unctions, potions, salves, tinctures, preparations. All that he had learned at the Black Watchtower from the monks. And Michael had always trusted him to do what needed to be done. Marvel ladled some soup from the pot that sat on the table. Michael ate the blandest gruel. It was part of his devotionals.
"Sousa has a new assistant with him now. He freed him from the jail. He thinks this man is some kind of prophet. A visionary."
"Is that so?"
He took a sip of water.
"John Sousa is not one to delegate responsibility. That's always been my impression."
"The man is a convict, as I said. A con man. I think he has befuddled Sousa in order to secure his release from the jail."
"Why is this a matter for my attention?"
Michael said. Like a good king, he was rarely emotionally bound to the concerns of his advisors, even his most trusted confidant, Marvel Whiteside Parsons.
"Well, that your chief orbital doctor may be under the sway of a convict, I thought you should know."
"What has this got to do with our friendship?"
He set his spoon on the tabletop.
"Nothing, sire."
He chuckled again.
Then why did you bring it up?
A swell of regret lifted Marvel, and as it crested, he found he could